150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. I'm gonna shine my way. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And they're into the stretch. Oh, my goodness.
This is the place to be.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
All right, welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Croucher here with Drew Dinsick, recording late Tuesday afternoon. Drew, on a screen directly in front of me, above your head from my view, I'm sweating out Barcelona-PSG. I would love Barcelona to get out of this tie. And let me tell you, nothing quite like being on a team in the Champions League and they cop a brutal red card 30 minutes into the game, and now they're going to have to somehow get through 45 minutes down to 10 men. And some teams play okay with 10 men and they just park the bus for 15 minutes. Barcelona play with 10 men. They don't know what they're doing. They had no shape whatsoever. So not super optimistic about that, but that's what's going on with me. What's going on with you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you want to play full strength? Don't trip. I don't know what to tell you. That was a wild one. I did not expect that to be a straight red. And Barca's in trouble, but if anyone can bottle it, PSG, I believe in them. This is the entire kind of Champions League so far has been kind of making my head spin. So I don't even know what I'm rooting for anymore. I'll be honest with you. I have so much stuff all over the place. So
it's legacy time, Xavi. Need you to figure something out here, because whatever you pulled at the end of the end of the first half wasn't working. By the time people listening to this, they'll have known. Certainly feels like PSG is going to win this game 3-1, though. But we will see. All right, today we're going to do an AMA. We'll get to a lot of questions, and then we'll close out with the NBA Finals MVP market. We have some sports-specific questions. Then we have some faux celebrities tuning in with some fake fun questions, and we'll get to all of that. But let's start off with Big Uncle 3X. How did you both start modeling for sports betting? Which sports did you choose? How has the process evolved?
Ooh, fun question. Talk a little bit of historical context here for how I got into to modeling. The first model I ever built was in Excel, and it used DVOA from the now defunct Football Outsiders, part of the FTN network, I believe. But Aaron Schatz and company published DVOA. I was like, oh, cool. You actually have somewhat of a neutral, a corrected, opponent adjusted, type of strength metric to use for offense, for defense, for teams, for running, for passing, for pace. Like it was just a mind opening, like, wow, like there's all of this data that is perfectly representative of what team strength should be. And we can kind of mash these numbers together and come up with kind of win probabilities and then carry this forward into a handicap, into power ratings, all of the above. This has long since not been profitable to do that in the blind, but it's nice to still have that as part of a composite model for ratings just in general, marrying that with EPA and sort of the other stuff that's now available through the NFL Fast R platform is pretty useful. And there are so many tools available to just come up with, sort of starting point data for NFL at a team level. And I would just kind of, recommend to everyone, look at it all through the lens of, is it adjusted for strength of opponent? Does it reflect, kind of success through the lens of what we know and understand to be important to scoring points on a drive, to winning football games? Is it correctly weighted for, kind of factors that could ultimately be important to a handicap? And if the answers are all yes, then it makes perfect sense to use that to train, any type of predictive model. After kind of getting involved making numbers for football, I got involved in making numbers for the NBA. And my approach was super sophisticated, Jay. I took offensive rating, defensive rating, pace projections, and I just mashed them together to get projected scores, and then just put some qualitative layers over that for rest, for player availability and things like that to tweak the numbers to come up with fares. And I, again, long, long have walked away from doing team level anything in the NBA, but that was where I started. And then maybe the most successful kind of attack avenue and data story I had was for tennis, where, you know, happened across Jeff Sackman's Tennis Abstract monster of a database that was available on GitHub, and used that to train, you know, tennis predictive models for in play, for, you know, for outrights, everything you could think of. You know, that's kind of my historical background when it comes to building models. And I think there are still some values in, you know, all of those things, but you kind of just have to try modeling for yourself, figure out what works for you. And maybe the best advice I can give anyone who's willing trying to build a sports model is, like, do it in a way that you're making it easier for yourself to continue to update it, to refresh it, to improve upon it. Like, you don't want to walk into any kind of a data science project with just this grand vision of, oh, I'm going to do this and we're going to capture all these attributes and all these, I have all these levers. And, you know, if you build something that's massively complicated, it's very tough to prove that it's plus EV, and then it's very tough to continue to maintain that. So you may never even know if you built something good. So I would just in general try to keep things pretty simple as you get started doing this, and then add wrinkles, add you know, add features as it makes sense to you, that you start to see results. You compare those results to, well, why is the market moving against me when I'm saying it should be going this way? It's going this way. You need to figure those things out. Any type of quantitative approach you take to coming up with a handicap is going to move you up a level from beginner to, you know, rec plus, which is a huge step forward if you're going to keep doing this.
Yep. No, I agree with all of that. As Ter Stegen absolutely butchered an attempt to save a ball, but was able to keep it out of the goal. So for what my background is, I don't code. I work with people who can code, which is very helpful. In terms of my own kind of betting background, I think my strength is that I worked at a book for 5 years, and I worked with feeds and feed providers, and I saw how people bet for 5 years across all client profiles, and I kind of developed a pretty good sense of what is difficult to beat in the market and what is much more vulnerable to beat in the market. And I think I have a pretty good sense of probability and logic, and I'm able to ask the right questions. And sometimes I can answer those questions by myself, just because the market is so off that an understanding of probability and logic is all that you need. And then for more difficult things, I have a network of people that I can consult if I need to, you know, actually understand something a little bit more mathematically and need basically some coding to get that done. So a lot of my betting, honestly, is just stuff like, all right, Lamar Jackson's plus 700 to win MVP, but the Ravens are plus 350 to sweep the Niners and the Dolphins, which would give them the one seed. Like, how does that make sense? And that's a big piece of it. And then another piece of it is just like, all right, well, Stade Brestois on top of Ligue 1, which is a pretty weak league, after 7 games, and the underlying stuff isn't that suspicious, and they're 50-1 to finish in the top four. That doesn't really make sense. And then being able to interrogate those questions, if I can do it myself, or using people in my network to get more conclusive answers. So that would be my background. I would say that just my kind of betting is not, it is replicable in a way where I don't code and I don't, I'm not a math genius or anything, but it's also my strength is that I worked and ran a trading team for a long time and was able to get all of this really invaluable background. I'd say for most people, and probably for myself as well going forward, is that it makes everything a lot easier if you know how to code. And that's what I would recommend for anyone who is trying to get into that. And then don't try and beat NFL lines of close from the jump. Try and attack more vulnerable markets, and then progress up from there.
Yeah.
Question from Ronan McGarry. Do you guys have any bad beat stories that will make me feel better about the Cavs throwing against the Hornets and costing me a 400-1 division fourfold? Drew?
That's a big one, man. That hurts. That stinks. Honestly, you want some sympathy though. About the same time that was happening, I was staring at just a hellaciously poor result in the Masters. Save one savior, and his name was Cam Davis. And Cam Davis shot the round of his. You know, he was having the tournament of his life. Really kind of was going to threaten, some top five, maybe doing really well, struggled on Sunday. But that was okay because he still was going to hit some of the junk pots, that were going to save my behind in the, high stakes Calcutta I was in. And, Cam Davis gets to 17. He's got the, he's I think top seven. He drives it. He's 123 yards from the pin. It's like, okay, good job. Like, take care, just get par these last two holes, and we'll head into the, we'll lick our wounds but we carry on. Cam Davis went on to then take five more strokes, after getting to within 123 yards of the pin on 17. He doubles. That moved him out of all of the junk pots that he was going to take home for me, out of the top seven, and it's to like tie for 12th. And, that double bogey on 17 was something like a mid five figure swing. Watching it play out in real time when he was as close as he was off the tee, I was just, I was in shock. And this is at, the tail end of just a number of like, how in the heck, like, when you're running bad, it's one thing to be like, oh, I made some stupid bet. Like, this is no chance. What was I thinking? Right. Like, it's one thing if that's the way it goes. It's another thing if it's like, okay, that was a good bet. I beat the market number. This, I would do it again. I would bet it again. And, oh, I'm in the lead. Okay, cool. Well, now I have like a 90% chance that thing's getting home. For those to lose hurts the most. And, the gutless calves, I'm not a superstitious person, Jay. I'm only a little stitious. But if the basketball gods do something terrible to them in these playoffs after what they did on Sunday, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, no, they are an absolute disgrace. The lack of confidence in your team to be able to beat the Pacers in round one is astonishing. And putting yourself into Boston side of the bracket because you want to save your job it's a disgrace. Like, it is just genuinely gutless. And I'm sorry, Ronan, that you're on the wrong side of that gutlessness. In terms of bad beats on my side, the first one that comes to mind is I had 2 years ago, the year the Judge won MVP and hit the 62 homers, I had a bet on Aaron Judge when he was 40-1 to win AL MVP, parlayed into Yannick Sinner to win the US Open that year. And he got to the quarterfinals and he played Carlos Alcaraz and he had a match point on his own serve. He lost that match point and went on to lose the match. I believe that parlay was about 1,000-1, and Judge got home, but Yannick did not. I can still see he got the first serve in, which was really the main part of the battle, because when he wasn't getting his first serve in, he was having no joy whatsoever, but gets it in, loses that point, and then goes on to just kind of collapse from there. And I know that Yannick Sinner is now a Grand Slam champion and everything, but I will never forgive him for not taking care of business that game, because then he would have played Tiafoe, he would have been a meaningful favorite, and then he would have played Casper Ruud in the final, he would have been a meaningful favorite. So thanks for nothing, Yannick. That's okay. To be fair, he had no business having a match point in the first place because Alcaraz violently outplayed him, but he got in that position and couldn't close it out. All right.
Wow.
Yeah, Yannick. All right. Question from Colin Ritter. What is a fair price for over 5.5 games for the Suns Wolves series? Feels like minus 220-ish is mispriced. Do you have any lean here, Drew?
Yeah, so I actually have a funnier take of I almost not a funnier take, but like I project this series as somewhat bimodal. The shorter, and that is to say that a long series to me favors the Suns pretty clearly. A short series to me favors the Timberwolves, because that means that, or if it is short, the likelihood that the Timberwolves get it home in five is, I think, pretty high. And so I almost want to say you're better off like picking into those markets, like the game handicap markets, or just take a price on the Suns right now to win the series, than you are betting over 5.5, because there are very clearly, in my opinion, more than some small ways for this thing to end in five. The adjustments that are available for the Timberwolves defensively to really try to make things difficult for the Suns and you know their intermediate range super game is pretty obvious to me. I think they are going to come in with eyes wide open on what they need to do defensively, and if they get offensive contributions like we have for the last half of the season out of Anthony Edwards, then this team is very, very, very much the better team. They have home games in 1, 2, and 5. And if they can win those games and get one in Phoenix, this thing probably goes 3-4-1 to Minnesota. If Phoenix, though, if they get their foot in the door in either of these first two games, which are both going to be about coin flips, then this thing is going the distance. And so I'm a little split where I'd rather almost take, if it goes long, then this is, you know, who will benefit from it, then I am just firing into a market with a minus 225 price.
Yep, that's fair. I'd rather just back the Suns at minus 118 to win the series, as I think they're going to win the series. All right, question from our friend Kurt Heelan at Basketball Talk. You're going to have to take this one, the first part of it, Drew. Who should I take in the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach this weekend?
Yes, Acura. The Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. So we have an annual spring tradition here in Long Beach. The IndyCar circuit comes to town. This has been going on since the early 70s, I want to say. And it draws about 200,000 people to come see the races. And Long Beach is part of a broader LA metro area that has 20 million people. So 200,000. No, Long Beach is a city of about 400,000. So this is a notable event. And it's a big deal. And the weather is usually absolutely perfect. And just seeing like IndyCars zipping around downtown Long Beach is wildly cool. It's a fun event. This is the second event of the IndyCar season. The first was in St. Petersburg, where you had, I believe, Joseph Newgarden was your winner. And he, of course, he's had success in Long Beach before. I think he won 2 years ago. Last year's Long Beach Grand Prix was a total shocker. Guy I actually had never even heard of before ended up taking it home. He might have even been a rookie, Kyle Kirkwood. I'm not a super experienced handicapper when it comes to IndyCar in particular or motor racing at all, in fact. However, I always do read about the Long Beach Grand Prix and then just in general read about the IndyCar circuit because they do come through in early April, or actually this is out now late April, but the two guys that I think you circle, Scott Dixon, he is kind of relatively well supported here, and I think is going to be, he's primed to have a huge season this year across the IndyCar suite. I really like what that team is doing, and I think Dixon finally gets his first Long Beach Grand Prix. And then I like Scott McLaughlin as well. He looks like he is set up to have a very successful season this year, and so I think he's a guy that you would circle as a potential surprise there. We don't have odds yet. We probably won't get him until qualifying is in the books. I believe qualifying is on Friday. But 3 days of racing, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, all in downtown Long Beach is going to be, it's going to be a grand time. A lot of friends and family coming into town to see that one. And if you've ever wanted to see, you know, racing in a downtown California setting, this is the best place to do it.
Okay, there you go. Scott Dixon is the play. Kurt's second part of that question, how many games do the Lakers upset the Nuggets in? 5, or is it a sweep? A little bit of a tongue-in-cheek question there from Los Angeles resident Kurt Heelan. I actually do think that the Lakers are a bit more live in that series, should that be the matchup, and you'll know by the time you listen to this whether it is the matchup. I think they're a little bit more live than perhaps most people expect, just because the Nuggets have been destroying the Lakers for a long time. It feels like, I just think this Lakers team is a little bit better than it was, the iteration that made the Western Conference Finals last year and also got swept. As someone who was heavily on the Nuggets to win the West, I came out of those first two games in Denver against the Lakers thinking that the Nuggets had kind of got out of jail and that 1-1 would have been a kind of fairer representation, and then the Lakers really should have won game 4 as well. But I just think this team, with LeBron healthier, with D'Angelo Russell playing much better, with Dinwiddie on the team, who I do think is useful, I think they're in a little bit better of a spot than they were. But who knows? By the time you're hearing this, the Lakers may well be fighting for their lives to play the Oklahoma City in round 1.
Yeah, I hope we get Lakers Nuggets 2-7. And much like, Jokic has dominated the Lakers, and not just in last year's Western Conference Finals, but just generally, much like Mbappe dominates this podcast, Jay, this guy just does not know when to quit, to put the wrong dirt on us. But last year's Western Conference Finals was hilarious because in the moment people were like, man, these are really competitive games. All the Lakers had their chances. Like, oh gosh, like they were so close. Like that. It was a weird, super high octane right out of the gate where the, Nuggets were just firing. Everything was falling for them early in that series. It really did set the tone, I thought. They were the more well-rested. They just had a couple of clear matchup advantages, and nothing that the Lakers were trying to do defensively against Jokic worked at all. Now, since that time, they've completely reshaped themselves. They're a much different style of basketball in general, which is credit to Ham and LeBron for, you know, how they have kind of changed the makeup of this team and just how they let, you know, what they're trying to do to win. And that could catch the Nuggets by surprise, to be honest with you. I mean, if the Nuggets think this is, oh, we got these guys easily last year, this is going to be a straightforward, you know, type of contest. Like, well, you know what? That didn't work out so well for the Warriors, who had so much success with against the Nuggets the prior season and then just got absolutely, you know, worked over by them, you know, in subsequent opportunities. So, you know, I would say that just in general, I agree that that will be a more competitive series than the market is going to make it. And I think it's probably going to come down to some of the supporting cast around Jokic, because honestly, you just kind of shrug your shoulders and say, okay, well, we'll let him have his, and we're going to try to make, you know, the Michael Porter Juniors of the world beat us. And, you know, there are a couple of players on the Nuggets in particular that I would point at and be like, look, these guys aren't like especially dynamic. They don't have range. They're not, you know, outside of Murray and Jokic, there's a lot of players that I think you can kind of put in a little bit of a box and force them to beat you the hard way. So, yeah, I think it would be a competitive series, but ultimately, am I going to bet the Lakers? Probably not.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it depends on the price. I don't think you're going to get any Lakers plus 400 that big of a price or anything, so it may not be a bet, but be interested to see what the market does put out there. I would guess the market puts out like Nuggets minus 300, minus 350, that type of range off the top of my head. But yeah, that would be interesting if that is the matchup, as Barcelona just absolutely melting in front of our eyes.
Your boy Xavi, he's out. He's gotten a red card as well.
There was talk that he might stay. Now he's not going to stay after the showing. It's not that hard to protect a 2-goal lead, even with 10 men, when you're at home. Anyway, question from Andy Vate. Does talk about clay tennis count as a question, or do you dress it up more? What are your thoughts about clay tennis, Drew?
Did you see what happened today, Jay? He's back. The king of clay, Rafa Nadal, took on an up-and-comer, a young player, a starstruck player maybe, in Barcelona. Barcelona is a tournament that Nadal owns. He owns it. The court is named after him. It is no joke that this is kind of his home, you know, home tournament. And seeing him play as well as he did today was phenomenal and encouraging. And while yes, Alcaraz was in the field and ultimately a late scratch, that is not a good sign. The hopes that we're going to kind of maybe rescue and get some sort of Nadal versus the world in the French Open is starting to come back into my consciousness, which I'm very, very excited for. I hope Nadal goes on and wins this tournament. I hope he then sits out of Madrid to rest, and then you know, kind of builds through a run in Rome to set up an opportunity to be a dynamic force at Roland Garros. A French Open without an inform Nadal is still going to be incredibly fun. There are a lot of players who you wanted to play well on clay already this season who have taken and shown you that they're not going quietly. Rude and Tsitsipas, who are the finalists in Monte Carlo, are probably your best examples. I'm pretty sure 90% of people who follow tennis were like, oh, I guess we're going to get our Djokovic-Sinner rematch. This is cool. It'll be on clay. This is fun. Rude and Tsitsipas had different ideas over the weekend as they both came away with impressive upsets. And then Tsitsipas ultimately lifting the trophy over an in-form Rude was impressive. So, yeah, there are a number of players who are playing really good, really, really, really good tennis right now. And I think you know, if Alcaraz can find any form between now and Roland Garros, it's going to be an epic.
Okay. Yeah. Hopefully that is our matchup with the legend against the new upstart in Carlito. Question from J-Rod. not to be confused with the slumping Julio Rodriguez. When will Jay announce he is backing Lude Miller to win a tournament? Background on this is my long-standing, I don't want to say infatuation because that has negative connotations, but I've always kind of been skewed towards backing Lude Miller Samsonova at big prices just because she has a ton of upside in her game. She just absolutely smashes the ball. She can play anyone off the court on her day. Problem is it's just not too often her day. I haven't been tracking Lude Miller's work too much lately, but as I look at her Tennis Abstract page, a lot of losses recently, really progressing very far in tournaments outside of Abu Dhabi, where she had, she beat Krejcikova and then got beaten pretty handily by Rybakina. But no, what's going on with Samsonova these days, Drew?
She's not only a lot of losses, some like... non-competes.
Yeah, it does melt. Like, it does really melt sometimes.
Yeah, like it's not like shocking who she's losing to, but shocking the degree to which she's competing is a problem. And like, you know, ultimately, like, what is her strength? This, you know, where is she best kind of tooled up to be a factor? It's probably in the fall. And it's definitely not on clay. Like if she does anything on clay this year, that's just kind of a bonus. I think she just needs to keep her head above water, and keep her ranking in a state where she's going to be able to get into draws without having to qualify once we get into the fall, and winter months, because that's where she is best, kind of geared up. And I mean, the answer is like, she's a fragile player. Like she's dealing with injuries. She's nowhere close to the form we saw when she was at her best, where she was literally world beating, and, you know, going off at 50-1 into the US Open, where she's, you know, fair price was something like, I don't know, 6-1. I think if she can just kind of keep it somewhat together throughout this clay stretch, then she's gonna have an opportunity to make some noise in the fall and winter, because everybody else in the women's side there, you're not seeing consistent runs of form right now at all. Like there's a lot of ups and downs, and there's a lot of like wear and tear and fatigue that these women are already showing, because they're, you know, the top tier are so good and they're so close that they're just doing damage to each other, making deep runs into tournaments and playing hard matches late into these tournaments. So I think ultimately it's not going to be the year of Ludmilla, but if you want to kind of put a pin in it and try to bet, you know, buy low on her come August, that would be the approach I would take.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, she'd be odds against whoever win a slam, I imagine, just because she's probably not quite that caliber, yeah. But she is the type of player who could absolutely have a Fernando Gonzalez type run to a Grand Slam final or something, to bring back that, where Gonzalez looked like the best player on planet Earth for a 2-week stretch in Melbourne once upon a time, and then got trucked by Federer in the final, I think. Yeah. That rings a bell. All right. Mm-hmm. Can Nelly Korda continue a hot start, Drew, and fend off the LPGA's finest at the Chevron Championship? Tune in from Thursday to Sunday this week for the first major of the season, only on NBC and Peacock.
150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
For the world's greatest athletes,
this is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again! Gold for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen. An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics, this summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
Okay, this is a good AMA question. Oh, wait, no, that wasn't the question?
No.
Okay. No. I actually, my LPGA golf model needs to tune up.
Good use of humor. No, the question is from our friend Dan Rosencheck. Wait, are you into wine too? Are you on Wine Berserkers or Cellar Tracker, UJ or both? Drew, you're a bit of a an aspiring connoisseur, or maybe not aspiring. I don't even know if that's the right adjective. Maybe you're just the connoisseur.
Yeah, I'm a wine travel enthusiast, I think is probably the category you would put me in. I don't have, I think actually here's a little maybe too much information, but if I struggle with anything, it's the old olfactory senses. I don't have a great sense of smell. And in order to be kind of a true kind of top tier wine connoisseur, you got to have the taste and the smell. I have outstanding taste buds, but the smell is just, it's rough. And so I have tended to kind of not really try hard to pivot into, you know, top tier wine stuff that you really need to cellar for quite a long time. I do have a, you know, a handful of older bottles that I, you know, have saved for special occasions, and I've gone through that, and, had specific vintages and from Napa, and like 2009 is a good example where, you know, you travel up there, you try it, you're like, whoa, this is going to be all, you know, all universe. Like this is as good as it ever gets. You buy it up, you cellar it, you save it for 10 years. And now that becomes your Easter, your Christmas, your New Year's, your Thanksgiving wines that you open up. And I think that's kind of my kind of general philosophy of how I look at sort of long-term wine tracking. Week to week type of stuff. I'm mostly into Pinot right now, just because there are a handful of like really, you know, fun appellations that we've gone and tried wine from, particularly in the Santa Barbara area that I just hugely fond of. And so kind of going through and trying, horizontals and different single blocks in areas where I know I like the Pinot grapes is sort of the current phase that I'm in. And then on top of that, wine traveling when it comes to Europe, like going trying some of the old world stuff. Last year we did a lot of tastings in Croatia. It was phenomenal. I thought the value was out of this world because you're getting wines that drink like $50 bottles for 20 in just random, you know, tiny little towns that are hard to, you know, that they don't have wide distribution. And this year, I think in the fall, the plan is we're going to do some tasting in south of France, which I'm excited about because that kind of pairs with what I'm into right now. And they have some world-class stuff there.
Okay. No, very well said, Drew. I decided I would kind of try and get into wine when the pandemic hit as kind of a little project because what else was there to do? And I bought a couple of wine books. And it just never really ignited, much like Barcelona's efforts when they went down to 10 men, never really ignited either. But I do have one recommendation around wine, and it's a book that was gifted to me by our mutual friend, Sprotsbetter on Twitter. The book is A Hedonist in the Cellar, Adventures in Wine by an author, Jay McInerney, who pens my favorite book of all time, which is called Bright Lights, Big City, which was made into a okay film with Michael J. Fox and Keith Sutherland in the late 80s, early 90s. But the book is magnificent. The best book ever, I will argue, written in second person. But anyway, he wrote this book, It's in the Cellar, which is all about kind of, wine adventures. And it is magnificent and well worth a read. So I cannot recommend you a bottle, but I can recommend you a book to do with wine. All right. Thank you for the question, Dan. And that was in response to you like to send out the AMA tweet with reference to wine and movies. And we have a question here from Cameron H7 around movies. Favorite A24 movies. A24 is a film production company that is kind of famous for, not arthouse makes it a little too niche, but films of lesser budgets, but critically revered films, often films like Moonlight and Room, Amy, Ex Machina, these types of films. Do you have a favorite or a list of favorites before I give out mine?
Well, for our audience, probably the, you would know A24 from the horror genre if you're into horror films. And if you, Midsommar. You know, like, if you like betting Champions League, then you probably are into horror films. but the, Midsommar is at the top of my list, surely. Like, I absolutely love that one. And, the other kind of clear, obvious winners, X and Pearl, which are a series that go together. Ex Machina was pretty outstanding. Like that's not really horror, but they have a Green Room. Oh, that was another one. Green Room that really stood out as pretty special. Hereditary stands out as pretty special. Like you basically could pick up, I think, in the blind an A24 horror movie and be pretty satisfied. Oh, The Witch. I forgot The Witch was A24 too. Man, I'm looking at the list of horror films, and this is like, these are some of the best that have been made in the last 20 years. Like almost like all of the good horror films since like the original Scream are probably A24 produced. So they obviously know what they're doing there. But more specifically for our audience, Uncut Gems is pretty entertaining watch, and you know, a lot of topical crossover for if you're interested in gambling in the NBA, which you presumably are if you're listening to this podcast. So if you haven't seen Uncut Gems, that one's pretty cool. But what's on your list?
So I've got a few. One, there is a 2014 film with Scarlett Johansson called Under the Skin, which is either the best film I've ever seen or the worst. I'm not entirely sure, but there is a lot going on in that film. I think it's well worth a watch just to trigger some thoughts about the world. It's by Jonathan Glazer, who he's done a range of movies. I'm just looking through his filmography. Now, The Zone of Interest, that's the one I was thinking of that he did recently, which is about the most grim watch you can ever see. Don't even really want to go into it right now, but that is exceedingly grim. Anyway, Under the Skin, grim, but not in the same way, but worth a watch if you want to think about some stuff. But the three that I wanted to call out, one, Mississippi Grind, which I think I've talked about here before. I've tweeted about, I think that is the best gambling movie ever made, with Ryan Reynolds and Ben Mendelsohn as a down on his luck gambler. They go on a road trip from Iowa, I think, down to New Orleans, stopping off and playing cards along the way. Ryan Reynolds was born for this role, in a complex performance from Ryan Reynolds, and Ben Mendelsohn is magnificent, one of the great Australian actors. And then the other two, Lock, which is basically just Tom Hardy sitting in a car on a phone call for the whole film, and it is magnificent. If you don't rate Tom Hardy, you go watch this film and you'll change your mind quickly. It is one of the great performances. If you like kind of single scene type of films, like, not to bring up Ryan Reynolds again, but Buried, this is very much for you. It's just an excellent film in its own right. And then I think maybe the best one of all, which is a film that I think is extremely underrated and doesn't get its credit, A Most Violent Year, directed by J.C. Chander. And it is stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain. It is about like the fuel supply industry in New York, New Jersey, but it's just extremely well done. Interesting kind of commentary for mine on masculinity. It's extremely well acted. I recommend it to absolutely everyone.
Cool.
Okay. That's
where are you on their major breakthrough, Everything Everywhere All at Once? Properly rated, overrated, or underrated?
I haven't watched it. Where do you stand?
I didn't really like it. I was shocked that swept the Oscars last year, if we're being honest with you. Like, here's a good explanation. Maybe I needed to see it on a big screen. I don't know. I started watching it on the plane. I got halfway through, and then I was like, I don't really need to keep watching this. And so then I eventually got back to kind of Oscar glory, and I was like, you know what? I guess I just got to sit down and watch it again. Maybe it was just because I was on a plane and I should have just, been on, a better experience. But I sat through and watched the whole thing again. I was like, okay, I get it. This is good. But not like sweep the freaking Oscars good. Like, okay, that's fine. It's just one of those movies that caught fire and had a great story because, Data from the Goonies was in it. And Jamie Lee Curtis's revival, and fine movie, but I think it's pretty fairly overrated.
Okay, fair. Yeah, my biggest controversial take on a film is I think the film Crash, which won Best Picture in 2006, I think it's I think it's a terrible film for a lot of reasons, and it's not really the
sure.
point to go with it, but I think it's actually kind of an offensive film, and I have no idea how it resonated enough to win Best Picture over Brokeback Mountain, which is a significantly better film. If you want to hear my
2006 was just a great year for cinema in general, and somehow Crash won. Yeah, I don't think that's a controversial take at all. I think people kind of widely pan that one. You want a real controversial take? 1986's winner, I believe, with The English Patient, unwatchable. Sure. Unwatchable. That is it. There are so many other tales you could have told to kind of capture that moment and the romance and the you know, war. That one was miserable.
Okay. Yeah. I can't think back to my feelings about The English Patient. The other one, while we're on this topic, firstly, the reason I don't like Crash is that it's a film about like racism, but it deals entirely in caricatures of race. Like yes. The film is like racist itself for the way it deals with race. But my other big take is that Born on the 4th of July, I think is a really bad movie. I don't know why people like it at all. I think there are significantly, is that Oliver Stone who did Born on the 4th of July? It is, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Like, I think Oliver Stone has much, much better films. Platoon, I think, is an all-time great movie.
JFK.
I prefer JFK to Born on the 4th of July. Born on the 4th of July, it's almost like a caricature of Americanism. I don't know. I think it's just so over the top and kind of not very well done. And I don't think it's one of Tom Cruise's like 5-6 best roles, and it's one that always gets brought up with him. So anyway, anti-Born on the 4th of July, anti-Crash, pro A Most Violent Year, and Lock. All right, question from Matthew Berry. At Matthew Berry TMR, who has been the best guest in Bet the Edge history and why is it me? Why didn't Jay shave for the cast photo, and how did the Nuggets lose to the Spurs? What's going on here? The third one is tongue-in-cheek. Matthew doesn't even know what sports the Nuggets and the Spurs play. Why didn't I shave for the cast photo? As I joked on Twitter, I wasn't aware that I could actually grow facial hair. And then who was the best guest in Bet the Edge history? Well, it's not Matthew who came on to talk about college basketball. He knows nothing about college basketball. I would volunteer that Tim Howard was the best guest, just in terms of stature, at least. What do you think?
That's a good one. Yeah. No, that the whole run of the soccer pub and some of the kind of very, very well-spoken and really, you know, well-researched folks, I learned a lot in that whole run. And I appreciate soccer more, having gotten to talk to a lot of those folks. So Tim Howard at the top of the list works for me.
Yep. Okay. Tim Howard it is. Congratulations, Tim. Very good. All right. The countdown is on. Wednesday is the 100-day mark to the Summer Olympics in Paris. Tune in this summer on NBC and Peacock to see the greatest athletes in the world go for gold in the City of Light.
For the world's greatest athletes.
This is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again! Gold for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this!
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics, this summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. I'm gonna shine my way. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And they're into the stretch. Oh, my goodness.
This is the place to be.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
Paris, not my favorite city at the moment, as PSG continues to lead 3-1 in Barcelona. NBA Finals MVP. Now, this market, which produced some rorts over the journey, now there's just a ton of juice in these markets where books are covering themselves somewhat and have figured out that superstar players need to be like at least 90% of the team's the finals MVP equity on a given team. But Jason Tatum is the favorite, plus 260. Nikola Jokic, plus 325. Jaylen Brown's the third favorite for finals MVP, which shows you how far in front the Celtics are in front of everyone else. He's plus 950. Then you have Giannis, who may not even play in these playoffs. SGA, Kawhi, Luka, Joel Embiid. Do you have any read on this market, any feel, any name you want to throw out?
I mean, it's 2024, Jay. Let's take the chalk.
Yeah,
I don't have a better. My more detailed breakdown though is Jokic is 100% of the Nuggets equity. Know that. Yes. And so if his price, if you're looking at a shop that has this number up, and his price is materially different than the Nuggets championship price, then that is a bet. And I think for the Celtics, it's a lot more complicated, but I personally think Tatum probably has more equity in the MVP market because he's just going to be able to produce more statistical output in the finals than any of these other characters, and particularly, you know, a guy like Jaylen Brown, that's an easy toss for me. Like, he's way too solvable to be effective over the balance of a best of seven series to the tune of being, you know, kind of that that impressive of a number. I think as you kind of go down the list, you want to try to make a case for Luka as 100% equity of the Mavs. I'll listen to it. You want to make a case for Joel Embiid as 100% equity for the Sixers. I'm right there with you in lockstep. If you think you know, any of these other teams like the Thunder or the Timberwolves could make some noise and get to this point in the year, I think you're probably better off just taking their outrights.
Yep, I think that's fair. I agree that Jokic needs to be like 99% of Denver's equity. The way that he would lose finals MVP is, I think you're talking about situations where the Nuggets go up 3-1 or something, and then he gets hurt and they win in seven. Like, bizarre, like complete outliers. There's just these guys like Jokic and Doncic, they just consume too much of the game statistically to lose, and they already have the rep. And in any close vote, as you saw in the Eastern Conference Finals MVP with Butler and Caleb Martin, if it is ever close, you tend to default to who the bigger name is and the bigger star. And so that is why the Iguodala winning Finals MVP, Tony Parker winning Finals MVP, these are massive outliers, particularly the Iguodala one, which is such a disgrace. Like, he should have finished third and he somehow won. Steph should have won. LeBron should have come second, and Iguodala should have finished third. I think the rot, or kind of semi-rot, rot adjacent the past couple of years is, I think the market has just not given enough of Boston's equity to Tatum, where the market was saying that Tatum was like a 70% chance, where for me, he was much closer to a 90% chance. I think the issue is this year is that, one, it is just a more egalitarian offense where now there are five guys who can do things. And that doesn't mean that, like, Drew Holiday is likely to win finals MVP, but it's just more likely that the scoring is going to be distributed widely enough that Jaylen Brown or Kristaps could win finals MVP. Now, I don't think that is likely, but I also do think, like, for Jaylen Brown's sense, like, he's gotten better this year. Like, he's gotten better as a player. And, you know, he probably won't have to play, or he doesn't have to play the Miami Heat in the NBA Finals, who he just cannot play against because they're so good at stripping him whenever he drives. So I think that we'll see how the playoffs go. We'll see how much Boston's offense becomes centered on Tatum in the playoffs. But I think the fact that the offense is a bit more egalitarian, that weighs against Tatum. Still, though, if I was to make one bet on the board, it still would be Tatum, just because there is such a tie-break lean to the best player on the team. And Tatum is clearly considered the best player on the Celtics, even if you don't think that he should be first-team All-NBA or, you know, fifth in MVP. He still clearly is the best player on that team, and he'll get it if it's close.
You think Celtics have, what, plus 150, plus 160-ish type of fare to win the championship right now?
I think that's fair. And so you're saying that, say they're plus 150. So
let's give them 40%. Let's give them 40% of the title right now. And yeah. Tatum's at plus 260. That's not bad.
So they're saying Tatum's 69% of Boston's MVP equity. That's a little bit low. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so if you want to bet on Boston to win the title, I would rather just get down on Tatum plus 260. Obviously, it's a little bit more difficult with liquidity on the finals MVP market, but just pricing them. Yeah, in
terms you want a little narrative nudge besides just the fact that 2024 is the year of the chalk? Tatum is less, you know, in the egalitarian world you're describing, he is less miles on him this year. And honestly, a ton of his failures in the last two seasons in the postseason, I think, could be pointed to injury, which was not like a specific injury, but fatigue-based injuries.
Yep. No, he just wasn't healthy at all in the finals against the Warriors. And then he wasn't, did his ankle against Miami in game seven. So it has been, I don't think he's gotten a fair shake in a way with how people are viewing some of the finales to his playoff runs, given that game seven wasn't his fault against Miami. And I just don't think that he was healthy against the Warriors. But yeah, anyway, hopefully he can do it. I'll be cheering for the Celtics. Hopefully he doesn't He doesn't melt. I don't think he will, and I think the Celtics will win, but we'll see. All right, we are done. Don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wagers. Thanks to those watching on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. If you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. Also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to amazon.com/NBC Sports. Jay Croucher and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you soon.